There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest episode of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I am so glad that you can join me for some cardboard conversation. And today's show is one of several we're going to do over the next few months, featuring some forgotten cardboard. No, not exactly rarities or sets that nobody bothers to collect. Actually, it's quite the opposite. No, they were actually somewhat forgotten by yours truly. Not totally forgotten, because I know these sets inside and out, but these are just sets that we had talked about in past episodes. In particular, early past episodes, because a lot of these are from the 1980s. There's one that we're possibly going to revisit from the early 90s. And if you've been a longtime listener of this show, you will recall the show started as a junk wax show, specifically from a monster box of cards that I had kept for many, many years. So a lot of these sets that we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks are sets from shows that I did four and a half, maybe even 5 years ago. You know, we're coming up on the fifth anniversary of the beginning of the show, which was back in the summer of 2016. So this is a fun look back at a few sets that once I did the first show, no matter how much I loved or didn't really love the set, I did the show and just moved on to the next show. Nothing wrong with that. But when you're looking back at some of these sets, it's good to take a fresh perspective of them. It's good to take a second look. And it's good to kind of see where these sets are fitting into today's hobby. Because the hobby today, as much as I hate to admit it, has really come back to the bad old bubble days of the mid-90s. It's kind of scary. And I've lamented having to buy new cards. I still have not bought a pack of Heritage because, well, I know where they are. They've been hoarded off of the shelves of Walmart and Target. And I was actually at a card show, first card show I've been to in over a year. They were all at a card show and all marked up. I think the smallest price I saw was $30 for a, not a blaster box, you know, the pack boxes that you get for $19.99 at Walmart or Target. And as, you know, eager as I am to open up some Heritage, I'm also not going to pay some lunkhead 50% above the cost of the cards just because he got to Target at 6 a.m. and I didn't. But anyways, I digress. You know, the hobby is revitalized, and it's interesting to see some of these sets from the 80s and even the early 90s, how old collectors are starting to rediscover them, but also how the value of certain cards is being measured. And the set that we're going to focus on with this episode is one of those sets that really checks all the boxes. It's a great design. It's got a ton of rookie cards. It's got a ton of Hall of Famers, both young and upcoming stars who would become Hall of Famers, and then veteran players who would become Hall of Famers. It's a set that is still plentiful, but not in large enough numbers to scare people off. And it is also very condition sensitive. So while many people are focused on inserts and refractors and parallel cards and all that stuff these days, this is the original short print, if you will. No, this is the original, conditioning factor that would cause people to cringe if they opened a pack that somehow, fell out of the box wrong. And you got that dinged corner and you knew, oh, well, that one's not worth as much as it should be. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you by popular demand, and I do mean popular demand because this was part of a Twitter poll we recently did, 1987 Donruss. This was a set, like I said, checks all the boxes, and despite checking all the boxes, is often overshadowed by one of the most legendary sets in the hobby, 87 Tops. And this set also somewhat shares the bastard child status that its other counterpart, Fleer, holds for 1987, because 87 Fleer was also an outstanding set that had a lot of the same characteristics as Donruss and Tops. It's just the 87 Tops set was so big in the growth of cards that, people still remember to this day where they were, what they got when they first started opening up 87 Tops cards. So, when you're going up against a behemoth of a counter set, it's very easy to understand why you would get overlooked. And 87 Donruss certainly does that. So we'll talk about 87 Donruss, some of the tough parts of getting those packs and completing sets. And again, how does it shake up in today's hobby? There are select cards from that 660 card set where if you're able to find one in a PSA 10 condition, it could pay handsomely, especially if it's a return on investment from, say, a $2 bargain bin pack, which is not really the case with a lot of, certainly pre-1988, but a lot of baseball card packs now, since the hobby fever continues to grow, even in what was once called the junk wax. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Now, I do want to mention that this program, this subject matter, was by popular demand. We ran a couple of Twitter polls on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. If you're not already following, please do. Tell your friends, tell your collector friends, past and present, about that. And we put out two votes. One was pre-1988 cards. And I wanted to see, okay, which set should we revisit? And obviously the top vote getter would get the win. And 87 Donruss just edged out 85 Tops. So we're going to look at both. 85 Tops, I'm having a little trouble securing affordable unopened packs. So that may be a situation kind of like what we did with Brad Blukjan a while back when the Wax Pack book came out. Rather than open up a bunch of 86 Tops packs, I just took out my then nearly completed, since then completed, hand-collated set. I've got a hand-collated 85 Tops set complete, so we'll probably pull a few random cards from there and talk a little bit about that set in a future show. Not necessarily the next show, but certainly in the near future. The second poll, which during the last program, I did not have the results yet because I recorded that show a little earlier than usual because I was getting my second COVID shot, which, by the way, no major side effects. So if you're still on the fence on that, please go get that COVID vaccine. Pfizer was my choice from the COVID vaccine salad bar. Side effects may vary. But anyways, I didn't get the results when I recorded the show, but I have them now. Definitely not a close vote. This one, far and away the winner, and we had a lot of comments about it, and I agree with the people. 89 Donruss from the junk wax era. We were looking at 89 Donruss. Let's see, who were the other ones? 91 Score, 90 Fleer, and 92 Donruss Triple Play. And 89 Donruss ran away with it. The second place vote kind of surprised me, was Triple Play. And I'll see if I can get my hands on some of those packs. But those will be some, not all, but some of the show topics that we'll be talking about over the next few weeks. So thank you for everybody who participated in those programs. Now, or in those polls, which will then help you participate in our program. There we go. I'm just connecting the dots a little too quickly there. Now, for those of you who do follow Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, again, if you click on the profile for the account, you will be directed to the Twitter profile, but you will also see in the biography of Wax and Gum Stains, the Wax Ecstatic channel, a link to a SurveyMonkey survey. Thanks to everybody who's responded to that. We've gotten a much better reaction to it, a lot of great feedback. It is a 5-question, multiple choice quiz, if you will. Just a survey, takes about a minute, asking you what you think about the show so far and what you would like on our website, waxandgumstains.com. That is one of those long-term summer projects. I've got a lot going on this summer. I don't want to divulge too many details yet, but I'll share that with you in a future show. But again, I, on top of just all this other stuff that I'm doing over the next several weeks, I do want to take my time in building this website to make it something that complements our podcast. So this offers up an opportunity for you to help build it. What should be on there? What shouldn't be on there? It's important to see that as well. And of course, if you have any handwritten suggestions, because I didn't do any fill-in-the-blank questions, but if you have any suggestions for the website or the show, feel free to just tweet me at Wax and Gum Stains or shoot me an email, waxandgumstains@gmail.com. That is our new account for the program. Also on the website, we'll have details on how you can make cash donations or cardboard donations to the program. And something I'm really leaning on, and it sounds like we've got a lot of support for this, having a database, if you will, at least a web page pointing people to card shops. Not just brick and mortar, but online. If you own an eBay store and you would like to promote it, small fee, but I can certainly give you some direction on that. And you know, we'll have some more surprises, some interesting things to come out of this website. So again, if you haven't taken the survey, it's still up and running. Certainly appreciate your 2 cents. Just go to Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, click on the profile, and inside the biography, you will see that link. One last bit of housekeeping. Don't forget to subscribe to the new Wax Ecstatic YouTube channel. The old YouTube channel was basically just my own personal Gmail channel, and we got a lot of followers, but then I was like, yeah, you know, not that I really post anything else, but we should probably, you know, actually have a legitimate Wax and Gum Stains YouTube channel. So we have Wax Ecstatic. It is up there now. And we certainly hope that you are able to follow us there. So please do subscribe if you have not already. There'll be nothing new showing up on my personal account anytime soon. All right, let's talk 87 Donruss, shall we? Like I said, by popular demand, a lot of fans love this set. And what's not to love? As I mentioned before, you've got some great rookie cards. All the sets in 1987 did. And, you know, a lot of love goes back to 87 Tops, and rightly so. Like I said, it's the design. It's memorable for a lot of people. Most collectors like it. Yes, believe it or not, there are a few that don't like it. I've met them. I've talked to them. So that is a case. You know, sometimes some people just don't like the 87 Tops design, and that's okay. But 87 Donruss is often overlooked because of the 87 Tops set and the big rookies. You know, when you think of 87 Tops, you think of Barry Bonds and Bo Jackson and Jose Canseco. But you get all of those guys and then some in 87 Donruss, if you're a big fan of rookie cards. So, yeah, you know what? You do get, you know, your Barry Bonds and your Bo Jackson. But you also get Greg Maddux, a rated rookie. And he's got a great porn stash, too. Boy, you know, we talk a lot about the 80s porn stashes in the video break for 87 Donruss, which, again, you can, you know, just click on the link in our Twitter timeline. We posted that yesterday, or follow the YouTube channel and you'll see those when they pop up. But boy, Greg Maddux is just looking en fuego in this picture of him and his rated rookie card. Also, some other big rookie cards that you will find in 87 Donruss. You've got Barry Larkin, also Rafael Palmeiro, and some other notable names that we need to get in the mix here, Mike Greenwell and David Cohn. Now, I should point out that the 87 Donruss Jose Canseco card is not his rookie card. You may recall in 1986, Canseco appeared in the base set for Donruss, a rated rookie there. So again, scooping tops at their own game there. But Canseco is still seen twice in the base set for 1987. Of course, his regular card, and he was one of the Donruss Diamond Kings. And the Diamond Kings, one of the regular parts of the Donruss set that collectors liked back then. Back then, of course, the Donruss Diamond Kings, the first 27 cards in the set, where there was kind of a quote-unquote team MVP who was depicted in a Perez Steele gallery painting. Speaking of Perez Steele, another legend of baseball, part of the puzzle that you could assemble. Of course, the late, great Roberto Clemente was the star of the 1987 Donruss set. So, you know, you've got some big names there. Like I said, Maddux, Jackson, you got Bunch, you've got Larkin. Also, again, not technically a rookie card, but I should mention Mark McGwire is in there as well. So, a lot of the same notable names that you get in the top set. So 1987, big reason, you know, why collectors love those sets, because those rookies in one form or a fashion are pretty much covered in all three sets there. Of course, that's another reason why the 1988 sets are not as popular, because the rookie class wasn't that great. But hey, that's not their fault now, is it? So you've got the rookies, you've got some tremendous young Hall of Famers too. You know who they are, the Ripkins, the Sandbergs, the Gwynns. And then you've got some of the more veteran players who were near the end of their careers, such as Mike Schmidt, still with some time to play, Nolan Ryan, as well as George Brett, Robin Yount, Paul Molitor, the usual bunch. And we should also mention Charlie Hustle, Pete Rose featured in the set as well, and we're not going to get into the Hall of Fame discussion there. But it is a great mix, because you also get some of the guys who are just pretty much merely hanging on in their careers at that time. You know who I'm talking about, the Tom Seavers, the Steve Carltons, those type of players, Phil Negro as well. And it's a great spectrum of players going back to the mid-1960s, and including young stars such as Maddux and McGwire and Bonds, guys who would play, you know, into you know, the early 2000s. So you've got this great 40-year spectrum of Hall of Famers as well. Now, the card design is very simple but very sharp. You've got the black border with kind of like a subset background as well, the you know, rows of baseball outlines, basically. At the bottom of the picture, in a very small strip, you've got the player's name, his position as abbreviated. And then in the lower right-hand corner, you've got a full-color team logo. You flip the card over, you've got this standard Donruss back of a baseball card back then. What they had started in 1985, you know, tweaked a little bit in 85. They actually started that design in 82. Very simple. The Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am. Look at it. You've got this goldenrod kind of color with black text, card number in the upper left-hand corner, player name and personal details front and center at the top. You've got the recent major league history, which, you know, is kind of a bugaboo for me. I prefer a lengthier major league history for a lot of these players. Again, you can't just summarize Mike Schmidt's career in his previous 5 years when it's 1987. And then you've got, you know, contract information, how a player was acquired, and some other interesting factoids as well. Conditioning is an issue for 87 Donruss. Now, is it as bad as, say, 71 Tops, where the slightest, you know, mishandling of a card could alter it? Not necessarily, and that's simply because Donruss was using a thicker, more sturdier white card stock in 1987 than Topps was. Topps was still using their thick brown cardboard stock, which tended to fray at the edges, rounded corners, and especially with the black ink that they used in 1971, that of course being Topps, very easy to chip away from it. You have a lot of fuzzy edges, not just corners. And boy, if you ever creased it, it looked pretty terrible. 87 Donruss, if you drop the pack and ding the corners, yeah, you're going to be crying a little bit because it's not perfect. But if you are able to pull out some fresh cards from a pack that do not have any kind of abnormalities to it, you're going to have a pretty snazzy set of cards here. 87 Donruss is also very similar to 85 Donruss. It's another set that is often overlooked and forgotten, again, because Topps had an outstanding set, had the McGuire rookie, had the first Topps card of Roger Clemens. Sound familiar? Yeah, this is like the 1987 sets all over again. And Fleer, of course, having a pretty solid effort in 1985 as well. So 85 Donruss not only getting the Shemp Howard treatment back then, but looking very similar too with the black borders, something in the background, not the row of baseball. They have three red stripes and then a yellowish kind of back to it. So some things recycled in 1987, yet it just seems to come off a lot better. And of course, by 87, Donruss has had 7 years to get it right. They took big strides in the mid-80s. And the 85 set does come up short a little bit. Photo quality, I should say, not the greatest. It's a sharp look to it, but not really extremely impressive, where somehow the 87 set actually sets itself apart from the pros of the 85 set as well. I like the 85 Donruss set, but if I had to compare 85 to 87, just on aesthetics, certainly it's a little harder to get your hands on 85 Donruss packs, but I would give the slight edge to the 87 set. Now, I was saying earlier, the PSA grades, and of course, grades may vary depending on where you go and who's actually looking at your cards and what they want to pay for it. But one thing that I've noticed about this recent refocusing on the hobby is some people are paying way too much money for junk wax era packs or, earlier 80s packs. And I think a lot of it is just the expectation of landing that big card. If you get that Greg Maddux rookie card and it's in gem mint condition and you go through the trouble of getting it graded by PSA and you get one that comes back at a 10, at last check, that could retail for $175. Not too shabby for a pretty average-looking card. And that is, according to the PSA website, psacard.com, that is the most valuable card in gem mint condition. Now, even if it's not in gem mint, if it's a lower grade, 8 or a 9, still, respectively, $6 for an 8, $20 for a 9, not bad. That's still not going to cover the cost of you shipping it out there to get it graded. But again, if you're looking on just the return of investment, if you, pick up several packs for, say, $20 and you land a Maddux and it's good enough to send off, might be worth your while. But, that's the reason why a lot of these pre-1988 packs are a lot harder to come by now. And that's kind of the downside of this, sweeping revolution of people rediscovering baseball cards. You've got the Hawks who are in there who will spend anything to get their hands on this, and then they will mark it up to drastic numbers because you're not looking at 87 Donruss, or at least a lot of people aren't looking at 87 Donruss because it's a nice set and it's from my childhood and 660 cards should be easy for me to collect. No, they know that there's a Maddux in there or there's a Bonds in there, and it could be worth a lot of money if it comes out pack fresh in gem mint condition. Not easy to do to get a PSA 10, but if you're lucky enough, you can certainly pay some bills with the returned product. So the Maddux card, valued at $175, Bo Jackson at $150. We were all robbed of a full Bo Jackson career Nobody under the age of 30 really knows or appreciates what Bo Jackson did. You see him appear in a commercial every now and then, but we were just absolutely robbed by, Bo Jackson's hip injury in 1991, and he was, able to string out his baseball career a few more years. But it's just amazing for a guy whose pro career in baseball lasted, 7 or 8 years, was electric to watch at the time. But when you look at the overall numbers compared to other players, it's kind of a blip on the radar, generally speaking. PSA 10, again, $150. So that's driving the market up just a little bit. Some other high-dollar numbers, Barry Bonds, PSA 10 will get you 90. Mark McGwire, PSA 10 will get you 75. And even the Larkin, this is one that you may go digging for, $35, Gem Mint 10. So if it's hard for you to come by the packs of cards, make sure you check those bargain bins, those $3 for $5 boxes at your local card show or at your local card shop, because some collectors, some sellers, they've been sitting on 20 of these Barry Larkin cards and they don't have the time or really the energy to send them all off to get graded, because if it comes back as an 8, nothing wrong with that, but that's only valued at $2. Well, why bother? But you can find some pretty sharp cards if you go digging around just a little bit. And if you want to go through the effort and roll the dice and hope for a 10, well, that card that you spent $1.75 on comes back at $35, then you've got a nice little return on your investment. So the 87 Donruss set, you can see why this was such a popular set and why it was just edging out 85 Tops. 85 Tops, an immensely popular set from that time. But 87 Donruss just looks a little sharper, looks a little cleaner, dare I say a little classier. And even though you've got your Puckett and your Clemens and your McGwire and 85 Tops, you've got a pretty heavy-hitting class in 87 Donruss with Maddux and Bonds and Larkin and McGwire and Bo Jackson and even the second-year Jose Canseco still has quite a bit of value to it. But, you're collecting this not because of just card values, right? We still like to do this because it's fun. And with that said, maybe you want to go looking for some 87 Donruss. Well, I highly recommend it because it is a great set for all the reasons I've explained. But buyer beware, again, because of just the fanaticism that's going on behind the hobby right now. There are a lot of products that are marked up way too much. Whether anybody actually pays for it is another issue, but it's a lot harder to secure some of the unopened wax from this time. If you want to go that route, you may just need to buy card lots or go fishing around for a factory set. It will cost you a little more than it would have 2 or 3 years ago, but it is, I think, worth the effort to either buy it whole or at least try to find enough of it to where you can pull it all together. But do beware, this 87 Donruss set, not that long ago, you could buy packs on eBay for roughly $1 a pack. They'd sell boxes for $35-40 a box. Nowadays, forget about it. I got 4 packs for this show. What did I spend? I think with shipping, it was $20, which is a little pricey. Now, granted, with shipping, there was probably about, $6 shipping, something like that. Thankfully, the buyer I bought it from is not located too far away from me, so I knew, despite the postal service problems of the day, that the cards would get to me in a decent amount of time, and they did. It only took 3 or 4 days. But I'm not used to, even if you take the shipping off, $14 for 4 packs, I'm not used to paying $3.50 a pack for 87 Donruss. So there might be a little sticker shock if you try to revisit this yourself. Again, just want to warn you. But if you have the time and you have the capital investment and you don't mind dropping, say, $60 or $70 on a box of 87 Donruss, I don't have that capital or that patience to pay that much money. But if you do, it could be worth your time to check it out all over again, because it is just a great set. You couldn't have asked for a better set from Donruss in 1987. And remember the history of Donruss too. Really, they finally found their footing in 84, put out that great set in 85, really underappreciated set in 86. Dynamite set in 87. I know most people don't like 88, but I still do. And then you've got the 89 set, which again, we'll talk about in a later show. You know, from that clunky, flimsy, bad photography, having to hire, you know, Keith Olbermann to take pictures for you at ballparks in the New York area, 81 Donruss set. You know, it's come a long way and in such a short time. And like I said, their track kind of goes right along with what Fleer was doing at the time. And this was kind of the very end of the, you know, the playful competition that you had, because Donruss was making good sets in 1987 or by 1987. Fleer was making good sets by 1987. That drove Tops to keep making good sets. Like even the sets that are kind of, you know, like an 86 Tops, they're still memorable. They're still valuable. There's still a lot to those sets, a lot of character. So, you know, the competition drove Tops to improve their product. And I think that's a big factor. What made that legendary 87 set and some pretty awesome classic looking sets in 88 and 89 as well. But of course, it's also kind of the end of the playful competition, because as sports flicks was dying away at this time, in comes Score, in comes Upper Deck, Tops releases Bowman all over again. You've got premium sets coming up, and then it just all goes off the rails in a wild fashion. So I like looking at the 87 sets, not just Donruss, but the other two as well. I like looking at them and just kind of thinking about, you know, just how well they were made. The boatload of stars, young and old, that are in them. Like I said, there's a spectrum of 40 years of incredible ball players covered in all three of those sets from 1987. And Donruss has a very classy, sharp, clean way of presenting it. And for those of you that don't like 87 Tops, you don't like the wood grain look, it's a little too cheesy, then may I suggest looking at Donruss or Fleer from 87, which certainly have the cleaner look if you're not into that wood grain design. All right, we're heading down the backstretch here, rounding third, heading for home. That's the bottom third of the order. Let's take a look at three cards, three players that I randomly selected from the four packs that I opened up here recently, including Dwayne Ward. Boy, you talk about overlooked and under-respected. Dwayne Ward was one of those guys who, you know, simply just kind of gets lost in the sands of time. But if you were a Blue Jays fan such as myself, or you were a you know, a fan of kind of the underrated players of the mid to late 1980s, Dwayne Ward is definitely on that list. Now, he was not originally a member of the Blue Jays. In fact, he was a first round pick of the Atlanta Braves back in 1982, ninth overall, and he signed that summer. Dwayne Ward, born in 1964, originally from Parkview, New Mexico, one of the few New Mexico natives to make it all the way to the major leagues. Of course, there were others, including Jim Kremel, and probably the most notable New Mexico native who's made it to the big leagues and who's done fairly well, Alex Bregman, of course, the second pick in the 2015 draft with the Houston Astros. Anyways, this New Mexico native would be raised in New Mexico as well, certainly catching the attention of the Atlanta Braves and other major league teams as he was starring in Farmington, New Mexico. It's a small town that has a very big youth baseball program, or at least did in the 70s when he was playing. And he was a star with the American Amateur Baseball Congress team from Farmington, as well as Farmington High School, known as the Farmington Scorpions. And he also starred in the Connie Mack World Series, which is an 18 and under baseball tournament that is, what do you know, hosted in Farmington. Now, he is known for his fastball, and he had a pretty wicked, powerful fastball, too. You know, not the Aroldis Chapman 102-mile-an-hour stuff here, but for the time, a pretty dominant fastball. Yet, despite this dominant fastball, just wasn't, you know, lighting the world on fire at the time. In fact, let me pull up his minor league stats here, because we love talking about the John Smoltz trade from Detroit to Atlanta. Well, believe it or not, Dwayne Ward actually has a part in that. But if you go looking through some of his stats from the Braves farm system at the time, yes, he was moving up the chain, going through Durham and Greenville and Richmond. But, you know, his earned run average is hovering around 5. You know, he was primarily used as a starter at the time, and that may have been the issue. Maybe he was just more, you know, set for relief work as opposed to being a starter. And he had a little bit of control problems, too. Sometimes gave up a handful more walks than strikeouts. So, understandably, the Atlanta Braves, after a few years of having Dwayne Ward in their system, just go, no, we're good. So, July 6th, 1986, they trade him to Toronto for Doyle Alexander. Yes, the crafty veteran who would throw junk at the plate, who eventually was traded for John Smoltz. And with Smoltz, and we've discussed this before, Smoltz, he was kind of the same as Dwayne Ward, you know, a prospect who just for whatever reason was not gaining any traction while he was in the minor leagues. And if you look at that deal at the time, 1987 playoff run, Tigers need a veteran arm. Yeah, who's this kid? I think he was in Double A at the time. They give up on him. It's essentially what the Braves did the summer before with Dwayne Ward. Now, even though he had a brief appearance with the Braves, he appeared in just 10 games as a member of the Braves, the Blue Jays give him a look-see, and he doesn't fare that much better in 1986. Appears in just 2 games, actually starts one, allows 4 runs, 3 of them earned, and only lasts a couple of innings in his time with the Blue Jays. So he has a very unflattering 1986 season. Doesn't look really well in 1987, even though he saw some limited playing time in Toronto. He spent most of his season in Syracuse. But things turn around in 1988 when Ward goes 9-3, is no longer part of the starting rotation. In fact, after the 87 season, he would never start a game in the majors once again. And when you have him coming out of the bullpen, all of a sudden, he's able to find that strike zone with a little more confidence. He's allowing fewer runs. And in fact, his earned run average would never top 3.77. That's a number that he had in 1989. Now, I should correct myself there, because near the very end of his career, things totally came apart. But when he was in his prime and an everyday player, Dwayne Ward was one of the most dominant setup men. And that is why he was often overlooked, because he was the guy who would show up in the eighth inning and set the table for Tom Henke, the Terminator, who would shut everything down in the ninth. Now, he was part of the Blue Jays 1992 World Series team, and when Henke departed for the Texas Rangers, Ward would take over the closer role in 1993. Basically, it was Mike Timlin, again, another young, hard-throwing righty who would have a very lengthy career in the big leagues. Timlin would set the table for Ward, and in 1993, Ward set the Blue Jay record for saves at that time with 45 in a total of 71 appearances, 2.13 earned run average, and managed to pick up a couple wins as well. Was also a representative at the All-Star game in 1993 with some controversy. I remember Cito Gaston managing the American League team, of course, the defending world champions, you know, the managers, the manager of the two teams that were in the World Series the year before. Managing the All-Star clubs. And I remember 1993, that game in Baltimore, Gaston came under fire for stocking his team with Blue Jays. Well, look at the lineup that the Blue Jays had in 1993. If I was Cito Gaston, I'd do the exact same thing. Who the hell cares, you know, if the, you know, the then American League Milwaukee Brewers were missing somebody, or, you know, a basement-dwelling team like the Cleveland Indians in 1993 was missing somebody. You know what? If I'm the manager, I'm going for the win at that time. So everything is just coming up Millhouse for Dwayne Ward after 1993. And then he suffered a major injury, and it wasn't like one of those, you know, throughout his shoulder kind of things, but he developed biceps tendonitis and missed the entire 1994 season. And just an incredible quick fall from stardom here. I don't want to say grace, but, you know, definitely fell off the radar, because here's a guy who, you know, gets the win for that crazy game four of 1993 World Series, that 15-14 win for the Blue Jays. Dwayne Ward, by the way, the pitcher of record as well in game six when Joe Carter hit the walk-off home run there. So Ward picking up a couple of bizarre but interesting wins along the way. And again, saves leader for in the American League, saves leader in Blue Jays history, makes that first All-Star team, but at the age of 30, gets that tendonitis and really struggles afterwards. He would appear in just four games for the Blue Jays in 1995. His earned run average was much higher than 3.77, a robust 27 in the handful of games that he appeared in. And that was the end of his career. That was it. Dwayne Ward was for several years a fill-in color commentator and a frequent guest on Blue Jays radio broadcast. Of course, the Blue Jays being really stupid this year and ending their radio broadcast. So Ward no longer a part of that. He's been living in Las Vegas, Nevada for well over 30 years now. He is a member of the, or an incoming member, I should say. He's been officially inducted, but of course there hasn't been a ceremony yet because this was supposed to be in 2020, but he will be part of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. So much like 87 Donruss, Dwayne Ward, often overlooked and underappreciated, and that's just a shame because, again, as a Blue Jay fan, I get to watch him on a regular basis, and it was fun to watch him and Henke, and then, like I said, in 93, Timlin and Ward. You just couldn't catch up to those pitches back then. Nowadays, you might because, again, their fastballs only topped out at about 97 or 98, just a few ticks down from a Chapman or some of the other flamethrowers these days. Now, the next card, this is a Larry Cox moment here for me, because when I was opening the packs, I saw the card and I called him Mr. Vertigo, because I remember Nick Asaski suffering major vertigo in his career. And for some reason, I thought that Asaski had suffered that vertigo. I don't remember where I heard the story, but for some reason, I thought he had suffered that vertigo after jamming a Q-tip in his ear too far. You know, he ruptured the eardrum, and that's what caused the vertigo, which shortchanged his career tremendously. I can't find that story. I don't know if there's any truth to that story, and I don't recall where it came from, but now I not only feel bad because, you know, Nick Asaski had a career-ending injury with vertigo, but also as I did a little more digging around the story, this guy has dealt with a lot of stuff in his life. So, yeah, a Larry Cox moment I'm about to share with you, where you, at first you hear the name and you go, oh, yeah, I kind of remember him, and then you go, oh, man. Well, let's start with the good news. Asaski, born in Hialeah, Florida, that's down near Miami, back in 1960, and he was one of the top young players in Hialeah, Florida, and was one of the early draft selections in the 1978 draft, first round selection, 17th overall by the Cincinnati Reds, and again, starring in Carroll City High School in Miami Gardens. So he works his way up through the Reds farm system, makes his major league debut in 1983, part of a rebuilding Reds team here, primarily an infielder at the time, third base and first base, could also play some outfield as well. So in 85 games, 23-year-old Nick Asaski in 1983, 265 batting average, is able to hit 12 home runs. So you're thinking, all right, this guy is going to be a part of this rebuilding Reds team. Well, 1984 falls flat on his face, hits only 193, still hits 10 home runs. He's got a little power, but in 113 games, a little bit of an underwhelming performance. Now, he would continue to play mostly a platoon role, again, starting to become more of a utility man, but able to put up some decent numbers in 1985, 1987 as well, and in 1988 had a halfway decent season of a 243 batting average and 15 home runs. Unfortunately for him, though, 104 strikeouts. The Reds have some younger players coming up, and they're also going to be making some moves, and one of them involves Nick Asaski. So he is traded to the Reds, or from the Reds, in December of 1988, along with Rob Murphy, to the Boston Red Sox for Jeff Sellers, Louis Vasquez, and Todd Benzinger. Now, Benzinger was a veteran who would be part of the Reds' World Series victory in 1990, but this isn't a bad thing for Nick Isasky, as the Red Sox need some utility work and you know, need to count on a guy who can be put pretty much anywhere on the field and deliver. And he certainly did that with the Red Sox, although he was primarily a first baseman in 1989 with them. But he had a star season with the Red Sox in 89 at the plate as well. 154 games played, 156 hits, which amounts to a .277 batting average, 30 home runs, 108 RBI. Somehow didn't get involved with the All-Star team that year, but it was a heck of a time to have a good year because it was a contract year for Nick Isasky. Now, the Red Sox don't want anything to do with this contract despite the solid numbers that Isasky put up, so they let him walk as a free agent. And in the winter of 1989, he signs a three-year deal with the Atlanta Braves. So, aha, this is a budding, dare I say, veteran. How old was he at the time? 30, I believe. And he can help guide some of these younger players. You know, the Braves were starting to rebuild at that time, too. Well, didn't work out real well for Isasky because of the vertigo. Whether or not that was actually caused by a Q-tip, yet to be determined. But after signing that three-year, $5.6 million contract with the Braves, then pretty big bucks, he had the vertigo from an ear infection and only appeared in just a handful of games in 1990 and was never able to make it back to the major leagues. Nine games with the Braves in 1990, couldn't play in 91 or 92, and was pretty much a bust. Now, fortunately for the Braves, they had his contract insured, so it was insurance that paid that. But think about what the Braves were paying at that time to guys with career-ending injuries. Nick Isasky making, $2.3 million a year. And Bruce Sutter was making a ton of money on a contract that he's still getting paid off of to this day. So he was forced to retire, could not appear in any more games, and it just a tragic tale of how that all unfolded. But wait, there's more tragedy in the story of Nick Isasky, and this is a story that I had no idea about at first. Now, Isasky, you're thinking of, all right, well, what's he going to do after his pro career? Well, it turns out, after several years, he decided to get into the anti-drug crusade, in particular, battling methamphetamines. Not Nick Isasky, but his daughter. She was a meth addict, was dealing with it for several years. So in the mid-2000s, about 2006, he started a foundation to help families who were dealing with family members who were addled by methamphetamines. So Isasky's story, his daughter experimented with drugs as a teenager, went to meth by the age of 19, gave birth to a baby who, of course, you know, is being fed this drug while her mother's taking it. And Isasky had to step in first to take care of the granddaughter, so he was able to get custody of the granddaughter, and then having to deal with his daughter because losing custody of her own child made her binge even more. And then finally, she was able to get into rehab. So thankfully, there is a happy ending to the story there, where he not only started this foundation, but from all accounts, from what I was able to see here, his daughter was able to get clean from meth and was able to return to a somewhat normal life. So that's the good thing there. Along with doing the methamphetamine anti-drug foundation, he is also running a health and wellness center back in South Florida. That is where he was at last check. And last but certainly not least, you know, we were talking about porn stashes from the PACs, and, you know, Greg Maddux has one. Well, there must have been something in the water in Chicago in 1986, because if there's anybody who has an incredible porn stash, and we got to see it twice in the four packs I opened it up, let's bring in the southpaw from Louisville, Kentucky, Drew Hall. Another first-round draft pick, third overall by the Cubs back in 1984, a star at Morehead State. And you can do whatever you want with the words porn stash and Morehead. I'm just going to leave that out for you. He was a star at Morehead State College, we should mention. Drew Hall, a very dominant lefty, in fact, held a record at Morehead State for most strikeouts in a game. He had 19 strikeouts against Eastern Kentucky during one of his seasons at Morehead State. He was there from 1982 to 1984. He was also a member of the 1984 Olympic team. He signed his pro contract with the Chicago Cubs, but the contract allowed him to remain as an amateur until the conclusion of the Olympics. So once that was done, he was able to move on up through the Cubs farm system, as was a second rounder that the Cubs drafted, a guy named Greg Maddux. So yeah, you go looking through the history books, the 1984 Major League Baseball draft, you look at the Cubs, Drew Hall, third overall, and then a round later, oh, here's that Hall of Famer, Greg Maddux, believe it or not. Interesting tidbit here, the highest draft pick by a Major League Baseball team from the state of Kentucky, even though his pro numbers don't exactly stand out. He was able to make his Major League debut back in 1986, where appearing in just five games, and in fact starting four of them, nothing special here, 4.56 earned a run average, and it wouldn't get a whole lot better, unfortunately, for Drew Hall. He would appear in 21 games in 1987, 19 games in 1988, and generally speaking, those were not good years to be Chicago Cubs pitchers. How is Hall rewarded for having to deal with not being on solid pitching staffs? He is sent to the heat and humidity in the world's largest frying pan. Yes, Arlington, Texas. He was part of a somewhat important trade. December 5th, 1988, traded by the Cubs along with Jamie Moyer and some guy named Rafael Palmeiro in exchange for a couple of career minor leaguers, Pablo Delgado and Luis Benitez, as well as Paul Kilgus, Kurt Wilkerson, Steve Wilson, and the wild thing, Mitch Williams. So interesting combination here. You've got a lefty trying to find himself, but you also have the eventually ageless Jamie Moyer and the controversial slugger in Rafael Palmeiro in that deal. Now, he would only spend 1 year in Texas. It was his best year, 38 games he made appearances in, 3.70 earned run average. Didn't save any games, but was counted on pretty much a situational pitcher from what I can see. Yeah, 58 and a third innings pitched in 38 games. So he was the crafty lefty that you called on the bullpen once or twice a week. Now, after the 1989 season, Hall is on the move once again, traded by the Rangers to the Montreal Expos for Jeff Hewson, and things go south for Hall after he goes north, where he appears in 42 games for the Expos. Again, not exactly a great team to be pitching for in 1990, with an earned run average of 5.09. Released by the Expos in 1990, in 1991, and that was the end of his career. Now, interesting story about Drew Hall. I wish I could remember the exact relation, but there was a friend of mine in middle school who claimed to be a relative of Drew Hall. I want to say it was like his second cousin or something like that. And I would kind of chuckle every time I would pull a Drew Hall card out of a pack of cards, because at this time in middle school, Hall was still playing. And I was amused by the cards whenever I pulled one with Hall, because supposedly, again, this classmate was somehow related to him. Now, Hall is, by the way, not only an alum of Morehead State, he was actually briefly a coach. He was a pitching coach for the team back in 2008, and at last check, still very active in youth baseball in Kentucky, and very active with that awesome mustache, Drew Hall. So that's the look at the bottom of the order there. Some interesting selections, Dwayne Ward, Nick Kosaski, and Drew Hall from a very interesting set. Again, 1987 Donruss should be easy to collect. It's not that old. There were plenty printed, not in scarce numbers. And at 660 cards, those are relatively easy sets to complete. But again, because of the fervor behind the industry right now, a little tougher to come by. At least you're going to be paying more for it. So again, buyer beware. There are markups right now. So perhaps check your local card shop. You may have a dealer there who's not looking to pay the bills with an 87 Donruss sale. You might be able to get some good deals there as opposed to an eBay seller. But also, you may be able to find a good deal just in a factory set. There are still plenty of 87 Donruss factory sets floating around out there. And sure, you might pay 40 or 50 bucks for it, especially because there's that Greg Maddux and Bo Jackson and all the other rookies that are in there. But it would be worth every penny, not just because of the handful of cards that, sure, you can get graded and make lots of money off of if you so choose to, but really more because it is just an outstanding set. And I'm glad we took a second look at it. It's just so funny, you know, you kind of mechanically kind of go through all of these sets. And especially at the pace of the show when I was first doing it, I was doing two podcasts a week. Now it's flipped around. It's a podcast every other week, but I was really aggressive when I started. And, you know, when you crank out just podcast after podcast after podcast, and you're like, okay, next set, next set, next set. It's very easy to look at some of these sets and go, yeah, that was pretty good. And then you just kind of move on. And, you know, that's kind of what we're dealing with some of the other sets we're going to look at. Again, 89 Donruss down the road, 85 tops, and perhaps some 92 triple play as well. The 87 Donruss, definitely a fun one. And even if you're not collecting the whole set, if you have that chance, you're at a show or a shop and you're going through the bargain box and for a dollar or maybe two, there are some 87 Donruss packs, go ahead and get them. They're really worth the fun of opening up the old packs. You've got a great looking card, great assortment of rookies and you know, all-stars and Hall of Famers, and it just looks so crisp. And it makes you forget about 88 Donruss. Again, I love 88 Donruss. I think it's better than most people want to admit. But that's a fight for another show some other time. Don't forget, you can email me at waxandgumstains@gmail.com. Don't forget to take the survey about the Wax and Gum Stains website, which we'll be working on over the next few months. You can find the SurveyMonkey link on our Twitter profile at Wax and Gum Stains. And once again, if you haven't already, follow us on our new YouTube channel. It's Wax Ecstatic. Look for the Wax Ecstatic logo. You'll see most of the videos that we used to have on the old channel up there. And that is where we release all the new videos. Last but not least, get those vaccines. No good reason to be on the fence here. Folks, the more people will get vaccinated, the more people get healthier, the less deadly the coronavirus is, and the more we can return back to normal. Have you felt that recently? It's starting to come back in most areas. It's nice to, you know, coach a Little League game and not have to wear a mask because you're outdoors and you're vaccinated. It's nice to see family members again and start thinking about catching up with friends at the bar and not being terrified of dying like you were 6 or 12 months ago. So if you haven't already, get those shots. They're practically available in every drugstore now, and they are free. They're effective. I had hardly any symptoms. Most of the people I know had very few symptoms. So please do that. In the meantime, mask up, wash those hands, stay socially distant, and let's tramp down this virus so that hopefully by the summer we're starting to get back into the swing of things. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for hanging around with us here at Wax Ecstatic. We'll get into the swing of things once again 2 weeks from this Friday. That will be May the 21st. That's the day. And we'll be talking about another exciting set, perhaps looking back at another lost gem in our next program. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.